Well, it's been a few years since I seen you. Last time we chatted, it was under happier circumstances. But I have a feeling things are beginning to turn around for you. And this book was so interesting about how all these problems develop. Interesting also because you do a number on the lawyers, justifiably, it would seem to me. But there's a sort of a sense of irony here in that George Tomasi is a fictional hero of yours, appeared in, I guess, three or four books.
Five novels about the law, four of them.
Yeah, he's a lawyer.
Yes, he is.
So how do you reconcile your anger and hostility for lawyers in A Feast for Lawyers with your hero?
Well, I purposely included a chapter saying some of my best friends are lawyers because I'm not against lawyers. I'm against the bankruptcy lawyers who exploit the system. You may recall that in the book I quote a very distinguished bankruptcy lawyer in Chicago who could name only 11 ethical bankruptcy lawyers. There are firms in this city that have 60, 70, 80 bankruptcy lawyers on their staff. It's sort of a level below ambulance chasing. What they do is they take advantage of a company that's in trouble that, according to the law, finds a kind of protection in Chapter 11 where, for a minute, all of the lawsuits against them and the creditors are stayed so that they can reconstruct their business. It's like a business hospital. That's the way to think of it. And what happens is that 70% of the people that enter that hospital die. Now, would you go to a hospital where you knew that the chances of dying were 70%? It's a very poor survival rate, and if you then take it down to the majority of companies, which are small or medium-sized companies, more than 9 out of 10 that enter that hospital die. It's something no businessman should do, and I think particularly it's something that every businessman whose business is in good shape ought to look into right now. I tell you, that book, A Feast for Lawyers, costs $18.95, and it would have been worth $2.8 million to me if I had had the information that's in that book in 1987. The trouble is that nobody who's ever been inside Chapter 11, no CEO, has ever been able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some confusion about Chapter 11 and Chapter 7. What's the difference between the two?
Well, there's a huge difference. Chapter 11 is supposed to allow a company time and the Chapter 11 allows a company time to reorganize its business. That's the purpose of the law. Chapter 7 is for the liquidation of the company. What we found out is that in most instances, Chapter 11 is used as a way of creating enormous lawyers' fees and at the same time having the people who run the company serve as the liquidators, which is getting cheap help.
But Chapter 7, now that's a complete liquidation.
Yes, that's
gone. I mean, it's no effort to reorganize at all. Just get
big
rid of
difference.
The assets.
Chapter 11 is supposed to be voluntary. You're not pushed into it by three restless creditors. Yet I found that in my surveys of the field that over 99% of companies going into Chapter 11 do it involuntarily, and not always because they're short of cash. A great many companies file for Chapter 11 protection because of a circumstance, a judgment that they can't meet, a surprise event that they can't meet. In our case, it was a restraining order. That is, the largest printer in the United States got a restraining order that said, you can't publish a book. If you try to publish a single book, we'll put you in jail. Well, the only thing I could do when we had a huge list of books ready to go, some of them manufactured, many of them already publicized to the trade, was file for protection. Well, I'll tell you something about protection. In this country, some businessmen, far too many businessmen, have to pay the mob in order not to get hurt. We know that as protection. In Chapter 11, you file for protection and you get hurt anyway.
Well, let's go back. Saul Stein, you've had a long and distinguished career as a writer and as a publisher. When did Stein and Day develop? When was it founded?
It was founded in 1962.
And I know its very first book was America, America.
Right, sold 3 million copies. We were off and running.
That's right. Some of your authors, tell me, in addition to Kazan.
Well, they range from the popular, such as Jack Higgins. I edited 7 of his bestsellers. to distinguished writers like J.B. Priestley and Dylan Thomas, many literary writers, many commercial writers, many public personalities like David Frost and Barbara Howard were authors of ours.
And you moved your publishing house away from Manhattan into the suburbs, which was a first, I think, since the publishing industry is very concentrated. And over the years, you were successful. You had bestsellers and prestigious writers. But then something happened. I think it, as you write in A Feast for Lawyers, it dealt with a paperback venture. Now, tell me how you started to get in trouble.
Well, we got into trouble in the richest, best financial year of our history, 1984. We had been publishing hardcover books and trade paperback books. Those are large-size quality paperbacks. And we had a very small line called Day Books of mass-market books. And everybody said, you've got to let that expand, and the only way to expand is to get a national distributor. Well, that national distributor that we signed up sold 7 million copies of our books, and the allegations that ended up in court were that we didn't get paid the money that was owed to us. We had to file the next year, in July of 1985, in federal court, certain claims against that company. And we hoped that because we are supposed to have a federal system that works quicker than the state systems, that we could hang in there until the courts gave us a trial and we saw justice. The fact is that a judge sat on that case for 3 years, handed it off to another judge who's had it for a year and a half, and now 4.5 years later, that has not come to trial, and the petitioner, the plaintiff, died in the meantime.
Now, this was you alleged that $7 million was due you.
No, I didn't allege $7 million. I said they sold 7 million of our books. They paid us some, but they didn't pay us for all. And we were very dependent on that cash flow for our business.
So you sued to get the money that you say was due.
Right.
How much money was that?
Well, the money that was owed to us, plus the consequent damages, that is, the things that happened as a result of not getting the money, on February 28, 1987, added up to $11.4 million.
What was the name of this paper book distributor, paperback distributor?
The Cable News Company.
Cable News. Then what happened? This still has not been resolved. Then what happened? What was the next turn?
Well, we explained the matters to all of our suppliers, to our authors. We had always paid in time, and we started paying slowly. But we were up to date with our banks and so on. But there was one creditor, R.R. Donnelly. They are the largest printer in the United States. And they decided that they would get a restraining order. And one day the sheriff came, and he was going to put a lock on the door except for the fact that we had two employees, the caretakers, who lived in the building. And the upshot was that we were not permitted under that restraining order to pay any employee or to publish any book. It was a nightmare. Yes. I always thought in this country you're free to not only conduct business but to ban the publishing of books. There were never in the history of our country so many books banned as under that restraining order from R.R. Donnelly.
Well, what was Donnelly's purpose in doing this?
Well, that's hard for me to judge because they didn't get a single penny out of it. I don't want to guess as to people's motivations. Sometimes people do things for foolish reasons. They got nothing out of it. What they did was to cripple a 25-year-old company that had been rated number 3 by Writer's Yearbook in terms of American publishing companies.
But perhaps they panicked. You were slow to pay, right? And they panicked?
We were slow to pay. I think what happened is that the chief financial officer had been someone who knew our company well and had become a friend and had extended credit to us. And then he moved upstairs to vice chairman, and somebody else came into that financial slot. And I think he wanted to show how tough he was.
Now, this other outfit, the one I believe, Michigan, isn't it?
Yes.
What was the name of this company, and how did it get involved?
There was a company named Bookcrafters that's a manufacturer of books and was one of our suppliers. They have as an employee a man by the name of Randy Kukuk, who lusted to be a publisher. And we got some bad clues, it must have been a year before filing, when he sent us several letters threatening that if we didn't keep up to date on our bills, he was going to push us into involuntary bankruptcy. He actually said that in writing. And a few months later, that same company was soliciting our business because we were making payments on account. And before we filed, the vice president of Michigan National Bank, which was our principal bank, came to see Patricia Day and me, and he said, you know, this fellow Kukuk took me out to lunch, and he said he wanted to take your place at Stein and Day. I think I can't guess motivation beyond that, but the fact is that he is today in charge of all of Stein and Day's books, though he's had absolutely no experience in publishing, nor has his company. Yeah. They were the chief villains in the case, and I think the book very clearly bears that out.
Yes, it does. You had problems with your own lawyers, though. You identify the first lawyer as what, Joe Doakes or something, I believe, right?
Yes, I do, to spare his reputation. let me explain. We didn't get our own lawyers. We were forbidden to use our own lawyers. You remember in the beginning of the book I talk about 10 lies about Chapter 11, and I think the very first one is you're able to retain counsel of your choice. We found a man named Joshua Angel, who was really an angel. He was a head of a bankruptcy firm, one of the, I think it's the second largest in New York, that is, of the insolvency firms. And he took a look at our papers, and he said, First of all, I don't need a retainer. I'm not going to charge fees against the estate. By the way, that's what they call you when you get into Chapter 11. It's a clue to how they think about you. They think of you as an estate, as being dead, when you're there to try to recover. Well, what happened was that the Michigan National Bank had come to New York to try to find a law firm. And what they did was they showed their papers to a partner in that law firm that Mr. Angel is head of. Now, there's a common tactic that's being used by companies, banks, lawyers all over the United States now, not much talked about, which is these companies or banks will purposely go out and talk to individual law firms that might conceivably be hired by their opponents. And once they've exposed their papers, they can then say, hey, fellas, you have a conflict of interest. You can't have them. Now, Joshua Angel agreed not to charge the company. All he wanted was a little piece of the action at the end of the line, equity. In other words, there would be no cost. We were forced to take another lawyer who charged the company over $300,000, which is more than the company spent on legal fees in 25 years of its existence. And the result was that between the lack of competence and the lack of our inability to hire the lawyer of our choice and being opposed by other lawyers who saw a way of milking the company, that's the chief thing you have to understand about the way bankruptcy law is practiced. The words used in the New York Times last Sunday was churners, milkers. These are the people who try to keep a case going as long as possible because all the time they're collecting very fat fees or at least are putting out bills. I mean, in this case, the company was so demolished and $16 million worth of assets were so destroyed that there wasn't enough left for the lawyers to collect their hard-earned fees.
The problem compounded itself over and over. The bank, your own personal bank in Westchester, got into the act. What happened there?
Well, that's used really as an indication of how much vindictiveness there is in this arena. The Scarsdale National Bank was used by Stein and Day for minor things like car loans, office equipment, telephone equipment, and sometimes for very short-term loans to tide us over a short period. For instance, we once borrowed $250,000 from them and for 90 days and returned it very quickly and so on. Whenever we borrowed a large amount of money, I guaranteed it. And then I would withdraw the guarantee at the end of that period when the money was returned. When Stein and Day filed for Chapter 11 protection, the Scarsdale National Bank went to law and after Saul Stein and Patricia Day personally, and they sued us for the money, claiming we had guaranteed the telephone system in the building, the car in the building. None of that was true. They found themselves a convenient judge who signed a piece of paper saying, I'm just looking at the documents, and for the other loan, there had said heretofore and hereafter, and they were claiming that meant that any future borrowings were automatically guaranteed personally by us. That judge, 3 weeks later, was indicted, but that didn't help us at all. So we had to appeal. Do you know how many tens of thousands of dollars it costs to appeal something? And in the end, Saul Stein and Patricia Day and others paid for the telephone system, paid for the car, and the Scarsdale Bank walked off with money that they were not entitled to by finding a way around the Chapter 11 situation.
There are other people involved in this, too. What about your authors? You obviously had bought manuscripts that were there in your office waiting to be published. You had a backlist. What about you?
I think the way the authors were treated by the whole Chapter 11 situation was really terrible. It's one of the worst aspects of the case, and it horrifies me. We knew many of these authors personally, still do, and many of them were very supportive during our time of trouble. Yet these authors, according to the bankruptcy law, have their contracts frozen. They can't be paid their royalties that they were owed. Their books cannot be published, and they can't take them away to give them to another publisher. Of the 700 authors we had, I think 3 or 4 maybe were able to have enough money to institute legal proceedings in bankruptcy court where they were able to wrest their books away by paying for it. That's and paying for it in money that eventually went to the Michigan Bank and Bookrafters. In other words, the authors had no recourse. Their sole ability to earn money is from their writing, except for those who do other things for a living. And they expect that a publisher will pay royalties on time and that the book will continue to be in print. Number one, we were not permitted to pay royalties. And number two, which is horrible, we were not allowed to reprint books even for which we had bona fide paid in advance orders. That's the most horrifying part of what happened. That is, as a result of what Donnelly did, no more production, no more sale. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't publish. We file for Chapter 11, and we find, instead of protection, what we got is the same thing we had before, only much more costly. We were not allowed to publish books. And a lot of the books that had been signed, edited, hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in time and in money in bringing them to the point where they're ready for publication will now never be published.
You could not do your work. You couldn't act as a publisher. I guess this became a full-time job just to defend yourself.
It's more than a full-time job. I have interviewed executives in all sorts of industries, in transportation, in food, and oil, and so on, who have been through the Chapter 11 experience. And to them, the worst part of it is that 90 to 100% of their time, they are spending it in a new business, the Chapter 11 business. There is no time to run your company, except one must remember that when a company is in this kind of situation, it needs its top people more than ever. The system is bankrupt. The bankruptcy system is bankrupt.
What did this do to you and Patricia Day personally?
Well, it did the same thing that it does for executives in all sorts of industries. I failed to find a single top executive or his partner in any industry who was not personally and seriously affected in terms of their health. Those are described in detail in A Feast for Lawyers. And I think the same thing happened to us. We lost all of our lifetime earnings. We lost the $300,000 I borrowed on my house to put into the company to try to save it. But more than that, we lost our health, and God knows how we held on to our sanity. if anyone reads the chapter about the three-ring circus, which we were totally unprepared for, and which is organized by the lawyers purposely to make you a lightning rod for every aggressive feeling that's available to anyone who's in the Chapter 11 situation. You see, we went in unprepared, and the problem is everybody goes in unprepared because they're not told. There are 700,000 lawyers in this country who don't know what really goes on in Chapter 11. They're the normal lawyers that people have who work for them and work for their businesses. What happens when the company is in trouble and is considering the possibility of Chapter 11 is they are steered to a bankruptcy lawyer. And that's when the trouble really starts.
Well, there were motions and delays and missed court dates, and this thing dragged on, well, year after year. What finally happened? What was the outcome?
The final resolution was that on February 21st, 1989, I was coerced into signing a piece of paper that was full of lies on threat of having my home taken away if I didn't sign it. And that piece of paper essentially gave all of the remaining assets of Stein and Day to bookrafters.
It was a sad postscript, too. The literary records of Stein and Day were about to be shipped to Columbia. What happened there?
Well, we were very honored in that Columbia University decided to set up two archives, one of Stein and Day and one of my personal papers. And we arranged, that was done by court order, by the way, and the judge ordered that these documents go to Columbia University. And at that hearing, bookrafters agreed. And it was all set up for April 19th for Columbia to come and to pick up something like 15 transfiles. And when they arrived, almost all of them were gone. They had been taken 2 days previously by bookrafters, moved to Michigan, to Chelsea, Michigan, in defiance of the court order. Nothing happened to them. I told the FBI, because it was merchandise that didn't belong to them, it was property that didn't belong to them, and nothing happened. Columbia University's attorneys looked into the matter, and finally, just a couple of weeks ago, after well over half a year, 11 transfiles finally arrived at Columbia University, so at least the history of all this is not lost to scholars in the future.
In spite of all this, you never stopped working. You continued to write novels. You started a separate little business, too. Tell me about that.
Well, curiously, I was visited at home by a Washington publisher named Christopher Beard, who runs a publication in the bankruptcy business. And he said I was the first CEO of a company that lived through Chapter 11 that was able to start a new company as an entrepreneur. Apparently, most of them are so beaten down by this horrible process that they get some job somewhere, what he called a job, where you don't have to really be in charge, and sort of live out the rest of their lives that way. I couldn't do that. I continued writing my books, but I also founded a software company within 2 months of the time that Stein and Day existed no longer. And it's called WritePro. It's the first creative writing tutorial program that's available for IBM and compatible computers. And the short version, Don, is that we have users in all 50 states and all six continents except Antarctica. It's been a tremendous success. We've had over 100 favorable reviews, some of them astonishing. And it's being used in schools and colleges already.
You ought to have a version for the Macintosh. That's my machine.
We actually, when the New York Times, which was the first paper, I believe, to review us, didn't mention that we were available only for the IBM version, and hundreds of Macintosh users called us on our hotline, and we have a list of their names, and actually we're now negotiating with programmers in that field and hope to have a Mac version available.
How does WritePro work?
It works in an extremely interesting way. The Times said it was like having an experienced editor and teacher sort of leaning over your shoulder, prodding you with questions and so on. What happens actually is within 5 minutes of starting the program, there are a few words on the screen, you're asked questions and you're answering them, you find yourself creating a character. And then you're asked questions about that character. And within minutes, you are seeing on the same screen your first version and your revised version. And there is nothing as encouraging to people to see immediate improvement. And we go from the characters to plotting, to building tension, to creating suspense, to how to make dialogue make a story move actively. And apparently, it's been very successful for another reason. That is, we have in WritePro a program which enables beginners, intermediates, and professional novelists and nonfiction writers all to use the same program, and they can then proceed at their own speed and according to their own talent and ability, which means that you can move up the line not by going from a beginner's program to an intermediate, but right through the same program. We have one of our users, one of our many professional novelists, a fellow from, I believe, Denver, Colorado, wrote a review for the National Writers Club in which he said that what WritePro taught me was all the things I hadn't known I'd forgotten. So that at every level of activity, WritePro enables you to do what no program has been able to do previously. And as a result, this is the first software ever selected by the Literary Guild, by the Military Book Club, the Science Fiction Book Club. Barnes & Noble has it right now in a 5 million copy catalog, and they never used software before. So I think the 3.5 million people out there who want to do creative writing and who have not had a place to turn to, or the ones who are doing it and who are constantly reinventing the wheel, now have a way of benefiting from the techniques that authors have developed over the last 200 years, because it's all in there.
Well, I'm a little confused. Say I am a novelist, and I have already started work on a book. WritePro can still help me to smooth this effort?
Oh, it certainly can, because what you do is you take your character and ask it the questions that would be asked of the mythical character that's in there, and you are able to see. Let me give you concrete examples. Suppose you've developed a character that's a heroine, and I will ask you, how is she vulnerable? Well, you may not have thought of making a heroine vulnerable, but in fact, in order to make a rounded character, a complete human being, a person has to have not only positive characteristics, but some characteristics that might be interpreted as negative. And it's also true for villains. For instance, one of the first things we ask about villains is your character, who's your antagonist, is he charming in any way? What are the things that seduce people and get them involved and interested in his villainous schemes? So you see how all of these questions can help you with your own work. In fact, WritePro is usable for the rest of your writing life, because anytime you've got a problem, you can bring it to WritePro, and WritePro unsticks you. There's no such thing as having writer's block anymore. No more, what do I write about and how do I do it? Because all you do is sit down with WritePro and you'll find yourself writing a story that really comes out of your mind. In one of the lessons, we try to show how you can create immediate suspense right on the first page and hook the reader. And it works wonderfully. But if 1,000 people do that lesson, you'll have 1,000 different beginnings of 1,000 different novels.
Did you write this yourself?
I wrote the program.
Are you a programmer?
No, I'm not a programmer. Many people try to push me into computers for a long period of time. And on a very important July 4th weekend, my daughter and her boyfriend hauled me to a computer store and made me buy my first computer. And the minute I began using it, I saw here is a marvelous way of being able to do things that I'd wanted to do all along. You know, when I sit with Anilia Kazan for 5 months over a book, that may be fine, but I can't sit with 500 people for 5 months. I have now spent 36 years training writers, some of them who've become national heroes and bestsellers and who have made millions and millions of dollars. But the question is, how could I clone myself? You know, I'm a senior citizen now, and one has to think of how do I pass this on to other generations and to other people in other places whose names I don't even know. And what I found is that the computer enables you for the first time to give something that can't be done in the classroom, which is immediate playback of your progress. And in the computer, you can take and have two things on the screen simultaneously. Also, computers are of enormous help to writers in that you can make changes and cast things about in different forms very easily instead of working with scissors and paste and pen and ink. And I think the happiest thing that has happened to me are not the 100 great reviews, but letters we get from some users. I remember some. A woman in Salt Lake City, Utah, wrote and said, you know, if all computer software was as easy to use as your great WritePro, we'd all be computer experts. And take the New York Times review. They said it's got a manual that's written in English. Now, that's astounding in this field. They said, but you don't even have to look in it. The program is so easy to use that you can just go right in and work it. I think that was the ingenuity that went into it, to make it simple for somebody so they could concentrate on their writing. For instance, people are always afraid of losing what they're writing on computers because of some glitch. In WritePro, everything you write is saved automatically. You don't have to do anything to save it. So it's always there, and you can print it out anytime you want to.
Where does one get WritePro?
The WritePro hotline is 914-762-1255. It's also available in some stores in California and Chicago and in New York.
But they can order it directly?
It can be ordered. The great majority of people have ordered it directly, and then they go on with further lessons. In fact, I feel like instead of my sitting behind the writer, I've now got writers pushing me to get the subsequent lessons out.
How much is it?
WritePro is $39.95. There's a service called NewsBytes that goes out to about 4.5 million people that said it's probably the best $39.95 you've ever spent in your life.
I'm waiting for that Macintosh version.
I'll be sure to get it to you. I'll mark you down for number one. The very first one goes to Don Swaim. Hold me to it.
So what's are you still living in Scarborough?
Yes, I am. I'm living in the house the bank tried to take away. Mm-hmm. I've lived there for over 26, 27 years.
And Patricia, what's she doing?
Well, she's very heavily involved in the WritePro program. She's, as you know, a professional editor. And what she does is to edit the material that I write before it goes to the programmer for programming.
Do you ever think that you might want to get back into publishing again? Book publishing, I mean.
People have talked to me about going back into book publishing, but I think that it's very unlikely that I will ever go back to it for a number of reasons. The period that I've passed through has been very painful, and I don't know if I want to relive some of that pain. At the same time, I find that from an economical point of view, from the point of view of the business of publishing, publishing software makes a lot more sense than publishing books. As you know from the papers, the book business is one with a very small profit margin and with quite a bit of hazard. In the software industry, you have a quite large margin if you run the business correctly. And I guess I'm also influenced by the fact that I'm getting playback from dozens, perhaps even hundreds of people, of what this is doing to help them in their lives. And you don't get that from readers, you know? There's a satisfaction in knowing that what you're doing is put almost immediately to use by people who use it day in and day out. And I'm thrilled by it, and I think I'll stick to it.
And still, though, book publishing, you've been involved in it for 40 years, and it's in your blood. That's a hard thing to shake.
Well, I'll never stop writing. Yeah. I mean, that's the point. I had two books published this year, and I have another one that's finished, and I intend to go on writing my books. And I am helping some people with their books, as I did with an editor on a private basis. But in terms of entering into the administration of a publishing company, I'll leave it to others who like to do that.
Yeah, well, it's true. You do have that creative urge that is manifesting itself in your writing. Did you, by the way, have trouble? This book is obviously written with a great sense of outrage and anger. Did you have a problem finding a publisher?
To some degree, I would say. That is, in one instance, the book was read by the editor in charge of business books for a very large publishing conglomerate who was very enthusiastic and wanted to publish it. The sales manager vetoed it. Unfortunately, that's what's happening in publishing today. That is, the business end can very much influence the editorial decisions that are made. But I'm delighted to have had George Dekay of M. Evans publish the book, because he's an entrepreneur the way I was. He runs a small publishing company that's had a lot of books on the bestseller list, and he can feel this book personally, and that's very important. If a publisher feels that a book is just another book on a list of many, that's one thing. If a publisher says, this is my lead book and my heart's in it as well as my money, I'm thrilled by that, and I'm very glad to have had him publish it.
Saul, is this the last word? Have you had the last word in this controversy?
Oh, I think not, because just yesterday there was a court date I did not attend, but I understand that every lawyer in the courtroom, and there are quite a few, had read the book, and so had the judge, and all of them were fuming at me. You see, what I've done is to expose what happens to companies inside Chapter 11, and that just hasn't been done before. They usually humiliate you and hurt you personally, financially and in other ways, so badly that you come out like the walking wounded ready for a veterans hospital.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, Saul Stein and the Feast for Lawyers. I wish you the best. Thank you very much.
Thank you.